Her crew began to disembark. Throngs of merchants, porters, whores, seamen and thieves gaped in shock. 9 of every 10 men coming ashore were black or brown. Ripples of excitement ran up and down the docks. Had the Lady Meredith indeed crossed the Sunset Sea? Were the peoples of the fabled lands of the Far West all dark-skinned as summer islanders? Only when Sir Eustace Hightower himself emerged did the whispers die. Lord Donald's grandson was gaunt and sunburned, with lines on his face that had not been there when he sailed. A handful of Old Town men were with him, all that remained of his original crew. One of his grandsire's customs officers met him on the dock, and a quick exchange ensued. The Lady Meredith's crew did not simply look like summer islanders. They were summer islanders, hired on in Sothorius, at ruinous wages, Sir Eustace complained, to replace the men he'd lost. He would require porters, the captain said. His holds were bulging with rich cargo, but not from lands beyond the Sunset Sea. That was a dream, he said. Soon enough, Lord Donald's knights turned up with orders to escort him to the High Tower. There, in his grandsire's high hall, with a cup of wine in hand, Sir Eustace Hightower told his tale. Lord Donald's scribes scribbled as he spoke, and within days the story had spread all over Westeros by messenger, bard, and raven. The voyage had begun as well as he could have hoped, Sir Eustace said. Once beyond the arbour, Lady Westhill had steered her sun-chaser south by southwest, seeking warmer waters and fair winds, and the Lady Meredith and Autumn Moon had followed. The big Bravosi ship was very fast when the wind was in her sails, and the High Towers had difficulties keeping pace. The Seven were smiling on us at the start. We had the sun by day and the moon by night, and as sweet a wind as man or maid could hope for. We were not entirely alone. We glimpsed fisherfolk from time to time, and once a great dark ship that could only have been a whaler out of Ib. And fish. So many fish. Some dolphins swam beside us, as if they had never seen a ship before. We all thought that we were blessed. 12 days of smooth sailing out of Westeros, the Sun Chaser and her two companions were as far south as the Summer Islands, according to their best calculations, and farther west than any ship had sailed before, or any ship that had returned to tell of it, at least. On the Lady Meredith and Autumn Moon, casks of Arbor Gold were breached to toast the accomplishment. On Sun Chaser, the sailors drank a spiced honey wine from Lannisport, and if any man of them was disquieted that they had not seen a bird for the past 4 days, he held his tongue. The gods hate man's arrogance, the Septons teach us, and the seven-pointed star says that pride goes before a fall. It may well be that Alice Westhill and the High Towers celebrated too loudly and too early there in the ocean deeps, for soon after that the grand voyage began to go badly wrong. We lost the wind first, Sir Eustace told his grandfather's court. For almost a fortnight there was not so much as a breeze, and the ships moved only so far as we could tow them. It was discovered that 12 casks of meat on Autumn Moon were crawling with maggots. A small enough thing by itself, but an ill omen. The wind finally returned one day near sunset, when the sky turned red as blood, but the look of it set men to muttering. I told them it boded well for us, but I lied. Before morning the stars were gone and the winds began to howl, and then the ocean rose. That was the first storm, Sir Eustace said. Another followed 2 days later, and then a third, each worse than the one before. The waves rose higher than our masts, and there was thunder all around, and lightning such as I had never seen before, great cracking bolts that burned the eyes. One struck the Autumn Moon and split her mast from the crow's nest down to the deck. In the midst of all that madness, one of my hands screamed that he had seen arms rising from the water, the last thing any captain needs to hear. We had lost all sight of Sun Chaser by then. All that remained was my lady and the moon. The sea was washing over our decks with every rise and fall, and men were being swept over the side, clinging uselessly to lines. I saw the Autumn Moon founder with my own eyes. One moment she was there, broken and burning, but there. Then a wave rose up and swallowed her, and I blinked, and she was gone. Quick as that. That was all it was. A wave. A monster of a wave, but all my men were screaming, "Kraken! Kraken!" And not a word I said would ever disabuse them. I will never know how we survived that night, but we did. The next morning the sea was calm again, the sun was shining, and the water was so blue and innocent a man might never know that under it my brother floated, dead with all his men. Lady Meredith was in sad shape, sails torn, masts splintered, 9 men amongst the missing. We said prayers for the lost and set about making what repairs we could, and that afternoon our crow's eye saw sails in the distance. It was Sun Chaser, come back to find us. Lady Westhill had done more than simply survive the storm. She had found land. The winds and raging seas that had separated her Sun Chaser from the high towers had driven her westward, and when the dawn broke her man in the crow's nest had espied birds circling a hazy mountain peak on the horizon. Lady Alice made toward it and came upon 3 small islands. A mountain attended by 2 hills, as she put it. The Lady Meredith was in no fit shape to sail, but with the help of a tow from 3 boats off the Sun Chaser, she was able to make the safety of the islands. The 2 battered ships sheltered off the islands for more than a fortnight, making repairs and replenishing their stores. Lady Alice was triumphant. Here was land farther to the west than any land had ever been known to be, islands that existed on no known chart. Since there were 3 of them, she named them Aegon, Rhaenys, and Visenya. The islands were uninhabited, but springs and streams were plentiful, so the voyagers were able to fill their casks with all the fresh water they required. There were wild pigs as well, and huge, sluggish grey lizards as big as deer, and trees heavy with nuts and fruit. After sampling some of those, Eustace Hightower declared that they had no need to go any farther. "This is discovery enough," he said. "We have spices here I have never tasted, and these pink fruits. We have our fortunes here in our hands." Alice Westhill was incredulous. 3 small islands, even the largest of them a third the size of Dragonstone, that was nothing. The true wonders lay farther west. There might be another Essos just beyond the horizon." "Or there might be another 1,000 leagues of empty ocean," Sir Eustace replied. And though Lady Alice cajoled and pleaded and wove webs of words in the air, she could not move him. "Even had I wished to, my crew would not allow it," he told Lord Donnell in the High Tower. "To a man they were convinced they had seen a giant kraken pull autumn moon beneath the sea. Had I given the command to sail on, they would have fed me to the waves and found another captain." So the voyagers had parted ways as they left the islands. Lady Meredith turned back east for home, whilst Alice Westhill and her Sun Chaser pressed on westward, chasing the sun. Eustace Hightower's voyage home would prove to be nigh as perilous as his voyage out had been. There were more storms to be weathered, though none as terrible as the one that had claimed his brother's ship. The prevailing winds were against them, forcing them to tack and tack again. They had taken 3 of the great grey lizards on board, and 1 bit his steersman, whose leg turned green and had to be removed. A few days later, they encountered a pod of leviathans. 1 of them, a huge white bull larger than a ship, had slammed into Lady Meredith of a purpose and cracked her hull. Afterwards, Sir Eustace had changed course, making for the Summer Islands, which he figured to be their nearest landfall. They were farther south than he had realized, however, and ended up missing the islands entirely, and fetching up instead upon the coast of Sothorios. "We were there for a full year," he told his grandsire, "trying to make Lady Meredith seaworthy again, for the damage was greater than we'd thought. There were fortunes to be had there as well, though, and we were not blind to that. Emeralds, gold, spices, aye, all that and more. Strange creatures, monkeys that walk like men. Men that howl like monkeys, wyverns, basilisks, 100 different sorts of snakes, deadly, all of them. Some of my men just vanished of a night. The ones who didn't began to die. One was bitten by a fly, a little prick upon his neck, nothing to fear. 3 days later his skin was sloughing off, and he was bleeding from his ears and cock and ass. Drinking salt water will make a man mad, every sailor knows that, but the fresh water is no safer in that place. There are worms in it almost too small to see. If you swallowed them, they laid their eggs inside you. And the fevers. Hardly a day went by when half my men were fit to work. We all would have perished, I think, but some summer islanders passing by came on us. They know that hell better than they let on, I think. With their help I was able to get Lady Meredith to Talltrees Town, and from there to home. There ended his tale, and his great adventure. As for Lady Alice Westhill, born Elissa of House Farman, where her adventure ended we cannot say. The Sun Chaser vanished into the west, still searching for the lands beyond the Sunset Sea, and was never seen again. Except, many years later, Corlys Valerian, the boy born on Driftmark in 53 AC, would take his ship, the Sea Snake, on 9 great voyages, sailing farther than any man of Westeros had ever sailed before. On the first of those voyages he sailed beyond the Jade Gates to Yeti and the Isle of Lung, and returned with such a wealth of spice and silk and jade that House Valerian became, for a time, the wealthiest house in all the 7 kingdoms. On his second voyage, Ser Corlys sailed even farther east, and became the first Westerosi ever to reach Ashai by the Shadow, the bleak, black city of the Shadowbinders at the edge of the world. There he lost his love and half his crew, if the tales be true, and there as well, in Ashai's harbour, he glimpsed an old and much weathered ship that he would swear forevermore could only have been Sun Chaser. In 59 AC, however, Corlys Valerian was a boy of 6, dreaming of the sea, so we must leave him and turn back once again to the end of autumn in that fateful year, when the skies darkened, the winds rose, and winter came again to Westeros. The winter of 59 to 60 AC was an exceptionally cruel one, all those who survived it agreed. The north was hit first and hardest, as crops died in the field, streams froze, and bitter winds came howling over the wall. Though Lord Alaric Stark had commanded that half of every harvest be preserved and put aside against the coming winter, not all his bannermen had obeyed. As their larders and granaries emptied, famine spread across the land, and old men bade farewell to their children and went out into the snow to die, so their kin might live. Harvests failed in the Riverlands, the Westerlands, and the Vale as well, and even down into the Reach. Those who had food began to hoard, and all across the 7 kingdoms the price of bread began to rise. The price of meat rose even faster, and in the towns and cities fruits and vegetables all but disappeared. And then the shivers came, and the stranger walked the land. The maesters knew the shivers. They had seen its like before a century ago, and the course of the contagion was written in their books. It was believed to have come to Westeros from across the sea, from one of the free cities or lands more distant still. Port cities and harbour towns always felt the hand of the disease first and hardest. Many of the small folk believed that it was carried by rats, not the familiar grey rats of King's Landing and Old Town, big and bold and vicious, but the smaller black rats that could be seen swarming from the holds of ships at dock and scurrying down the ropes that held them fast. Though the guilt of rats was never proved to the satisfaction of the citadel, suddenly every house in the 7 kingdoms, from the grandest castle to the humblest hut, required a cat. Before the shivers ran its course that winter, kittens were selling for as much as destriers. The marks of the disease were well known. It began, simply enough, with a chill. Victims would complain of being cold, throw a fresh log on the fire, huddle under a blanket or a pile of furs. Some would call for hot soup, mulled wine, or, against all reason, beer. Neither blankets nor soups could stay the progress of the pestilence. Soon the shivering would begin, mild at first, a trembling, a shudder, but inexorably growing worse. Goose prickles would march up and down the victim's limbs like conquering armies. By then the afflicted would be shivering so violently that their teeth would chatter, and their hands and feet would begin to convulse and twitch. When the victim's lips turned blue, and he began to cough up blood, the end was nigh. Once the first chill was felt, the course of the shivers was swift. Death could come within a day, and no more than one victim in every five recovered. All this the maesters knew. What they did not know is where the shivers came from, how to stop it, or how to cure it. Poultices were tried, and potions. Hot mustards and dragon peppers were suggested, and wine spiced with snake venom that made the lips go numb. The afflicted were immersed in tubs of hot water, some heated almost to the point of boiling. Green vegetables were said to be a cure, then raw fish, then red meat, the bloodier the better. Certain healers dispensed with the meat and advised their patients to drink blood. Various smokes and inhalations of burning leaves were tried. One lord commanded his men to build fires all around him, surrounding himself with walls of flame. In the winter of 59 AC, the shivers entered from the east and moved across Blackwater Bay and up the Blackwater Rush. Even before King's Landing, the islands off the Crownlands felt the chill. Edwil Celtigar, Magor's one-time hand, and the much-despised Master of Coin, was the first lord to die. His son and heir followed him to the grave 3 days later. Lord Staunton died at Rook's Rest, and then his wife. Their children, frightened, sealed themselves inside their bedchambers and barred the doors, but it did not save them. On Dragonstone, the Queen's beloved Scepter Edith perished. On Driftmark, Daemon Valerian, Lord of the Tides, recovered after being at the point of death, but his second son and three of his daughters were borne away. Lord Bar-Emon, Lord Rosby, Lady Jarrell of Maidenpool, the bells tolled for them all, and many lesser men and women besides. All across the Seven Kingdoms, the noble and humble alike were struck down. The old and the young were most at risk, but men and women in the prime of their lives were not spared. The role of those taken included the greatest of lords, the noblest of ladies, the most valiant of knights. Lord Prentice Tully died, shivering in River Run, followed a day later by his lady Lucinda. Lyman Lannister, the mighty lord of Casterly Rock, was taken, together with sundry other lords of the Westerlands, Lord Marbrand of Ashmark, Lord Tarbeck of Tarbeck Hall, Lord Westerling of the Crag. At Highgarden, Lord Tyrell sickened but survived, only to perish, drunk, in a fall from his horse 4 days after his recovery. Rogar Baratheon was untouched by the shivers, and his son and daughter by Queen Elissa were stricken but recovered. Yet his brother, Sir Ronald, died, and the wives of both his brothers. The great port city of Old Town was especially hard hit, losing a quarter of its population. Eustace Hightower, who had returned alive from Alice Westhill's ill-fated voyage across the Sunset Sea, survived once again, but his wife and children were not as fortunate. Nor was his grandsire, Lord of the Hightower. Donald the Delayer could not delay death. He died shivering. So did the High Septon, 20 of the most devout, and fully a third of the archmaesters, maesters, acolytes, and novices of the Citadel. In all the realm no place was as sorely afflicted as King's Landing was in 59 AC. Amongst the dead were two knights of the King's Guard, old Sir Sam of Sour Hill, and the good-hearted Sir Victor the Valiant, along with three lords of the council, Albin Massey, Carl Corbray, and Grand Maester Benefer himself. Benefer had served for 15 years, through times both perilous and prosperous, coming to the Red Keep after Magor the Cruel had decapitated his three immediate predecessors. An act of singular courage or singular stupidity, his sardonic successor would observe. I would not have lasted 3 days under Magor. All the dead would be mourned and missed, but in the immediate aftermath of their passing, the loss of Carl Corbray was felt most grievously. With their commander dead and many of the city watch, stricken and shivering, the streets and alleys of King's Landing fell prey to lawlessness and license. Shops were looted, women raped, men robbed and killed for no crime but walking down the wrong street at the wrong time. King Jaehaerys sent forth his King's Guard and his household knights to restore order, but they were too few, and he soon had no choice but to call them back. Amidst the chaos, his grace would lose another of his lords, not to the shivers, but to ignorance and hate. Arrigo Dras had never taken up residence in the Red Keep, though there was ample room for him there, and the king had made the offer many times. The Pentoshi preferred his own manse on the Street of Silk, with a dragon pit looming above him atop the Hill of Rhaenys. There he could entertain his concubines without suffering the disapproval of the court. After 10 years in service to the Iron Throne, Lord Rigo had grown quite stout, and no longer chose to ride. Instead, he moved from manse to castle and back again in an ornate gilded palanquin. Unwisely, his route took him through the reeking heart of Flea Bottom, the foulest and most lawless district of the city. On that dire day, a dozen of Flea Bottom's less savoury denizens were chasing a piglet down an alley, when they chanced to come upon Lord Rigo moving through the streets. Some were drunk, and all were hungry. The piglet had escaped them. And the sight of the Pentoshi enraged them, for to a man they held a master of coin to blame for the high cost of bread. One wore a sword, three had knives. The rest snatched up stones and sticks and swarmed the palanquin, driving off Lord Rigo's bearers and spilling his lordship onto the ground. Onlookers said he screamed for help in words none of them could understand. When his lordship raised his hands to ward off the blows raining down on him, gold and gemstones glittered on every finger, and the attack grew more frenzied still. A woman shouted, "He's Pentoshi! Them's the bastards brung the shivers here!" One of the men pried a stone up from the king's newly cobbled street and brought it down upon Lord Rigo's head again and again, until only a red mash of blood and bone and brains remained. Thus died the Lord of Air, his skull crushed by one of the very cobblestones he had helped the king lay down. Even then his assailants were not done with him. Before they ran, they ripped off his fine clothes and cut off all his fingers to lay claim to his rings. When word reached the Red Keep, Jaehaerys Targaryen himself rode forth to claim the body, surrounded by his king's guard. So wroth was his grace at what he saw that Ser Joffrey Doggett would say afterward, "When I looked upon his face, for a moment it was as if I were looking at his uncle." The street was full of the curious, come out to see their king, or gaze upon the bloody corpse of the Pentoshi money-changer. Jaehaerys wheeled his horse about and shouted at them, "I would have the name of the men who did this. Speak now, and you will be well rewarded. Hold your tongues, and you will lose them." Many of the watchers slunk away, but one barefoot girl came forward, squeaking out a name. The king thanked her, and commanded her to show his knights where this man might be found. She led the king's guard to a wine-sink, where the villain was discovered with a whore in his lap, and three of Lord Rigo's rings on his fingers. Under torture, he soon gave up the names of the other attackers, and they were taken, one and all. One of their number claimed to have been a poor fellow, and cried out that he wished to take the black. "No," Jaehaerys told him, "the Night's Watch are men of honour, and you are lower than rats." Such men as these were unworthy of a clean death by sword or axe, he ruled. Instead, they were hung from the walls of the Red Keep, disemboweled, and left to twist until they died, their entrails swinging loose down to their knees. The girl who had led the king to the killers had a kinder fate. Taken in hand by Queen Alysanne, she was plunged into a tub of hot water for a scrubbing. Her clothes were burned, her head was shaved, and she was fed hot bread and bacon. "There is a place for you in the castle if you want it," Alysanne told her when her belly was full. "In the kitchens or the stables, as you wish. Do you have a father?" The girl gave a shy nod and admitted that she did. "He was one of them bellies you cut open, the poxy one with the sty." Then she told her grace that she wanted to work in the kitchens. "That's where they keeps the bread." The old year ended, and a new year began. But there were few celebrations anywhere in Westeros to mark the coming of the 60th year since Aegon's conquest. A year before, great bonfires had been lit in public squares, and men and women had danced around them, drinking and laughing, whilst bells rang in the new year. One year later, the fires were consuming corpses, and the bells were tolling out the dead. The streets of King's Landing were empty, especially by night. The alleyways were deep in snow, and icicles hung down from the rooftops, long as spears. Atop Aegon's high hill, King Jaehaerys ordered the gates of the Red Keep closed and barred, and doubled the watch on the castle walls. He and his queen and their children attended sunset services at the castle sept, repaired to Magor's holdfast for a modest meal, and then retired to bed. It was the hour of the owl when Queen Alisande was awoken by her daughter, shaking her gently by the arm. "Mother," Princess Daenerys said, "I'm cold." There is no need to dwell on all that followed. Daenerys Targaryen was the darling of the realm, and all that could be done for any man was done for her. There were prayers and poultices, hot soups and scalding baths, blankets and furs and hot stones, nettle tea. The princess was 6, and years passed being weaned, but a wet nurse was summoned, for there were some who believed that mother's milk could cure the shivers. Maesters came and went, septons and scepters prayed. The king commanded that 100 new rat-catchers be hired at once, and offered a silver stag for every dead rat, grey or black. Daenerys wanted her kitten, and her kitten was brought to her, though as her shivering grew more violent, it squirmed from her grasp and scratched her hand. Near dawn, Jaehaerys bolted to his feet, shouting that a dragon was needed, that his daughter must have a dragon, and ravens took wing for Dragonstone, instructing the dragon keepers there to bring a hatchling to the Red Keep at once. None of it mattered. A day and a half after she had woken her mother from sleep, complaining of feeling cold, the little princess was dead. The queen collapsed in the king's arms, shaking so violently that some feared she had the shivers too. Jaehaerys had her taken back to her own chambers and given milk of the poppy to help her sleep. Though near exhaustion, he went next to the yard and loosed Vermithor, then flew to Dragonstone to tell them there was no need for the hatchling after all. On his return to King's Landing, he drank a cup of dream wine and sent for Septon Bath. "How could this happen?" he demanded. "What sin did she commit? Why would the gods take her? How could this happen?" But even Barth, that wise man, had no answers for him. The king and queen were not the only parents to lose a child to the shivers. Thousands of others, high-born and low, knew the same pain that winter. For Jaehaerys and Alysanne, however, the death of their beloved daughter must have seemed especially cruel, for it struck at the very heart of the doctrine of exceptionalism. Princess Daenerys had been Targaryen on both sides, with the blood of old Valyria running pure through her veins, and those of Valyrian descent were not like other men. Targaryens had purple eyes, and hair of gold and silver. They ruled the sky on dragons. The doctrines of the faith and the prohibitions against incest did not apply to them. And they did not get sick. Since Aenar the Exile first staked his claim to Dragonstone, that had been known. Targaryens did not die of pox or the bloody flux. They were not afflicted with red spots or brown leg or the shaking sickness. They would not succumb to worm bone or clotted lung or sour gut or any of the myriad pestilences and contagions that the gods, for reasons of their own, see fit to loose on mortal men and women. There was fire in the blood of the dragon, it was reasoned, a purifying fire that burned out all such plagues. It was unthinkable that a pure-born princess should die shivering as if she were some common child. And yet she had. Even as they mourned for her and the sweet soul she had been, Jaehaerys and Alysanne must also have been confronting that awful realization. Mayhaps the Targaryens were not so close to gods as they had believed. Mayhaps, in the end, they too were only men. When the shivers finally ran its course, King Jaehaerys went back to his labours with a sadder heart. His first task was a grim one, replacing all the friends and counsellors he had lost. Lord Manfred Redwine's eldest son, Sir Robert, was named to command the city watch. Sir Giles Morrigan brought forth 2 good knights to join the King's Guard, and his grace duly presented Sir Ryan Redwine and Sir Robin Shaw with white cloaks. The able Albin Massey, his bent-backed justiciar, was not so easily replaced. To fill his seat, the king reached out to the Vale of Arryn and summoned Roderick Arryn, the erudite young lord of the Eyrie, who he and the queen first met as a boy of 10. The Citadel had already sent him Bennifer's successor, the sharp-tongued Grand Maester Elisar. 20 years younger than the man whose chain he donned, Elisar had never had a thought he didn't feel the need to share. Some claimed that the Conclave had sent him to King's Landing to be rid of him. Jaehaerys hesitated longest when it came to selecting his new Lord Treasurer and Master of Coin. Rigo Draz, however despised, had been a man of great ability. "I am tempted to say you do not find such men lying about in the streets, but if truth be told, we are more like to find one there than sitting in some castle," the king told his council. The Lord of Air had never married, but he did have 3 bastard sons who had learned his business at his knee. Much as the king was tempted to reach out to one of them, he knew the realm would never accept another Pentoshi. "It must needs be a lord," he concluded gloomily. Familiar names were bandied once again. Lannister, Valerian, Hightower, houses built on gold as much as steel. "They are all too proud," Jaehaerys said. It was Septon Barth who first proposed a different name. "The Tyrells of Highgarden are descended from Stewards," he reminded the king, "but the reach is broader than the Westerlands, with a different sort of wealth, and young Martin Tyrell might prove a useful addition to this council." Lord Redwine was incredulous. "The Tyrells are dolts," he said. "I am sorry, Your Grace, they are my liege lords, but the Tyrells are dolts, and Lord Bertrand was a sot as well." "That is as it may be," Septon Barth admitted. "Lord Bertrand is in his grave now, however, and I am speaking of his son. Martin is young and eager, but I will not vouch for the quality of his wits. His wife, however, is a Fosaway girl, the Lady Florence, who has been counting apples since she learned to walk. She has been keeping all the accounts at Highgarden since her marriage, and it is said she has increased House Tyrell's incomes by a third. Should we appoint her husband, she would come to court as well, I do not doubt." "Alysanne would like that," the king said. "She enjoys the company of clever women." The queen had not been attending council since the death of Princess Daenerys. Mayhaps Jaehaerys hoped that this would help bring her back to him again. "Our good Septon has never led us wrong. Let us try the dolt with a clever wife and hope that my leal small folk do not beat his head in with a cobblestone." The 7 take, and the 7 give. Mayhaps the mother above looked down on Queen Alysanne in her grief and took pity on her broken heart. The moon had not turned twice since Princess Daenerys's death, when Her Grace learned that she was once again carrying a child. With winter holding the realm in its icy grip, the queen once again chose caution and retired to Dragonstone for her lying in. Late that year, 60 AC, she was delivered of her 5th child, a daughter she named Alysa after her mother. "An honour Her Grace would have appreciated more had she been alive," observed the new Grand Maester Elisa, though not in the king's hearing. Winter broke not long after the queen gave birth, and Alysa proved to be a lively, healthy child. As a babe she was so like her late sister Daenerys that the queen oft wept to behold her, remembering the child she had lost. The likeness faded as the princess grew older, however. Long-faced and skinny, Alysa had little of her sister's beauty. Her hair was a dirty blonde tangle, with no hint of silver to evoke the dragon lords of old, and she had been born with mismatched eyes, one violet, the other a startling green. Her ears were too big, and her smile lopsided, and when she was 6 playing in the yard, a whack across the face from a wooden sword broke her nose. It healed crooked, but Alysa did not seem to care. By that age her mother had come to realize that it was not Daenerys that she took after, but Balon. Just as Balon had once followed Aemon everywhere, Alysa trailed after Balon. "Like a puppy," the Spring Prince complained. Balon was 2 years younger than Aemon, Alysa nearly 4 years younger than him, and a girl, which made it far worse in his eyes. The princess did not act like a girl, however. She wore boys' clothes when she could, shunned the company of other girls, preferred riding and climbing and dueling with wooden swords to sewing and reading and singing, and refused to eat porridge. An old friend and old adversary returned to King's Landing in 61 AC, when Lord Rhaegar Baratheon rode up from Storm's End to deliver 3 young girls to court. 2 were the daughters of his brother Ronwell, who had died shivering, together with his wife and sons. The 3rd was Lady Jocelyn, his lordship's own daughter by Queen Alysa. The small, frail babe who had come into the world during that terrible year of the stranger had grown into a tall young girl of solemn mien, with large dark eyes and hair black as sin. Rogar Baratheon's own hair had gone grey, however, and the years had taken their toll of the old king's hand. His face was pale and lined, and he had grown so gaunt that his clothes hung loose upon him, as if they had been cut for a much larger man. When he took a knee before the Iron Throne, he had trouble rising back to his feet, and required the help of a king's guard to stand. He had come to ask a boon, Lord Rogar told the king and queen. Lady Jocelyn would soon be celebrating her 7th name day. She has never known a mother. My brother's wives looked after her as much as they were able, but they favoured their own children as mothers will, and now both of them are gone. If it please you, sires, I would ask you to accept Jocelyn and her cousins as wards, to be raised here at court beside your own sons and daughters. It would be our honour and our pleasure, Queen Alysanne replied. Jocelyn is our own sister, we have not forgotten. Our blood. Lord Rogar seemed much relieved. I would ask you to look after my son as well. Boromund will remain at Storm's End in the charge of my brother Garen. He is a good boy, a strong boy, and he will be a great lord in time, I do not doubt, but he is only 9. As your graces know, my brother Boris left the Stormlands some years ago. He grew sour and angry after Boromund was born, and things went from bad to worse between us. Boris was in Myr for a time, and later in Volantis, doing gods know what. But now he has turned up in Westeros again, in the Red Mountains. The talk is that he has joined up with the Vulture King and is raiding his own people. Garen is an able man and leal, but he never was a match for Boris, and Boromund is but a boy. I fear for what may befall him and the Stormlands when I am gone. That took the king aback. When you are gone? Why should you be gone? Where do you mean to go, my lord? Lord Rogar's answering smile showed a glimpse of his old ferocity. Into the mountains, your grace. My maester says that I am dying. I believe him. Even before the shivers, there was pain. It has gotten worse since. He gives me milk of the poppy, and that helps, but I use only a little. I would not sleep away what life remains to me. Nor would I die abed, bleeding out of my arse. I mean to find my brother Boris and deal with him, and with this Vulture King as well. A fool's errand, Garen calls it. He is not wrong. But when I die, I want to die with my axe in my hand, screaming a curse. Do I have your leave, your grace? Moved by his old friend's words, King Jaehaerys rose and descended from the Iron Throne to clap Lord Rogar by the shoulder. Your brother is a traitor, and this vulture, I will not call him king, has vexed our marches long enough. You have my leave, my lord, and more than that, you have my sword. The king was true to his word. The fight that followed is named in the histories as the 3rd Dornish War, but that is a misnomer, for the Prince of Dorne kept his armies well out of the conflict. The small folk of the time called it Lord Rogar's War, and that name is far more apt. Whilst the Lord of Storm's End led 500 men into the mountains, Jaehaerys Targaryen took to the air on Vermithor. He calls himself a vulture, the king said, but he does not fly. He hides. He should call himself the gopher. He was not wrong. The 1st Vulture King had commanded armies, leading thousands of men into battle. The 2nd was no more than an up-jumped raider, a minor son of a minor house with a few hundred followers who shared his taste for robbery and rape. He knew the mountains well, however, and when pursued he would simply disappear, to reappear at will. Men who came hunting him did so at their peril, for he was skilled at ambuscade as well. None of his tricks availed him against a foe who could hunt him from above, however. A legend claimed the Vulture King had an impregnable mountain fastness, hidden in the clouds. Jaehaerys found no secret lair, only a dozen rude camps scattered here and there. One by one, Vermithor flamed them all, leaving the Vulture only ashes to return to. Lord Rogar's column, winding their way into the heights, were soon forced to abandon their horses and proceed on foot along goat tracks, up steep slopes and through caves, whilst hidden foes rolled stones down about their heads. Yet still they came on, undaunted. As the Stormlanders proceeded from the east, Simon Dondarrion, Lord of Blackhaven, led a small host of Marcher knights into the mountains from the west, to seal off escape from that side. Whilst the hunters crept toward one another, Jaehaerys watched them from the sky, moving them about as once he had moved toy armies in the chamber of the Painted Table. In the end, they found their foes. Boris Baratheon did not know the mountain's hidden ways as the Dornish did, so he was the first to be cornered. Lord Rogar's men made short work of his own, but as the brothers came face to face, King Jaehaerys descended from the sky. "I would not have you named a kinslayer, my lord," his grace told his former hand. "The traitor is mine." Sir Boris laughed to hear it. "Rather name me a kingslayer than him a kinslayer," he shouted as he rushed the king. But Jaehaerys had Blackfyre in hand, and he had not forgotten the lessons he had learned in the yard on Dragonstone. Boris Baratheon died at the king's feet, from a cut to his neck that near took his head off. The Vulture King's turn came the new full moon. Brought to bay in a burned lair where he had hoped to find refuge, he resisted to the end, showering the king's men with spears and arrows. "This one is mine," Rogar Baratheon told his grace when the Mountain King was led before them in fetters. At his command, the outlaw's chains were struck off, and he was given a spear and shield. Lord Rogar faced him with his axe. "If he kills me, let him go free." The Vulture proved sadly unequal to that task. Wasted and weak and racked with pain as he was, Rogar Baratheon turned the Dornish man's attacks aside contemptuously, then clove him from shoulder to navel. When it was done, Lord Rogar seemed weary. "It seems I will not die with axe in hand after all," he told the king sadly. Nor did he. Rogar Baratheon, Lord of Storm's End and one-time Hand of the King and Lord Protector of the Realm, died at Storm's End half a year later, in the presence of his maester, his septon, his brother Sir Garon, and his son and heir Boromund. Lord Rogar's war had lasted less than half a year, begun and won entirely in 61 AC. With the Vulture King eliminated, raiding fell off sharply along the Dornish marches for a time. As accounts of the campaign spread through the Seven Kingdoms, even the most martial of lords gained a new respect for their young king. Any lingering doubts had been dispelled. Jaehaerys Targaryen was not his father Aenys. For the king himself, the war was healing. "Against the Shivers I was helpless," he confessed to Septon Barth. "Against the Vulture I was a king again." In 62 AC, the lords of the Seven Kingdoms rejoiced when King Jaehaerys conferred upon his eldest the title Prince of Dragonstone, making him the acknowledged heir to the Iron Throne. Prince Aemon was 7 years of age, a boy as tall and handsome as he was modest. He still trained every morning in the yard with Prince Balon. The two brothers were fast friends and evenly matched. Aemon was taller and stronger, Balon quicker and fiercer. Their contests were so spirited that they oft drew crowds of onlookers, serving men and washerwomen, household knights and squires, maesters and septons and stable boys. They would gather in the yard to cheer on one prince or the other. One of those who came to watch was Jocelyn Baratheon, the late Queen Alyssa's dark-haired daughter, who grew taller and more beautiful with every passing day. At the feast that followed Aemon's investiture as Prince of Dragonstone, the queen sat Lady Jocelyn next to him, and the two young people were observed talking and laughing together through the evening, to the exclusion of all others. That same year, the gods blessed Jaehaerys and Alysanne with yet another child, a daughter they named Maegel. A gentle, selfless, and sweet-natured girl, and exceedingly bright, she soon attached herself to her sister Alyssa in much the same way that Prince Balon had attached himself to Prince Aemon, though not entirely as happily. Now it was Alyssa's turn to bristle at having the baby clinging to her skirts. She evaded her as best she could, and Balon laughed at her fury. We have already touched upon several of Jaehaerys's achievements. As 62 AC drew near its end, the king looked ahead to the year dawning, and all the years beyond, and began to make plans for a project that would transform the Seven Kingdoms. He had given King's Landing cobblestones, cisterns, and fountains. Now he lifted his eyes beyond the city walls to the fields and hills and bogs that stretched from the Dornish marches to the Gift. "My lords," he told the council, "when the Queen and I go forth on our progresses, we go on Vermithor and Silverwing. When we look down from the clouds, we see cities and castles, hills and swamps, rivers and streams and lakes. We see market towns and fishing villages, old forests, mountains, moors and meadows, flocks of sheep and fields of grain, old battlefields, ruined towers, lich yards and septs. There is much and more to see in these seven kingdoms of ours. Do you know what I do not see?" The king slapped the table hard. "Roads, my lord, I do not see roads. I see some ruts if I fly low enough. I see some game trails, and here and there a footpath by a stream. But I do not see any proper roads. My lords, I will have roads." The building of so many leagues of road would continue throughout the rest of Jaehaerys's reign and into the reign of his successor. But it started that day in the council chambers of the Red Keep. Let it not be thought that there were no roads in Westeros before his reign. Hundreds of roads crisscrossed the land, many dating back thousands of years to the days of the first men. Even the children of the forest had paths they followed when they moved from place to place beneath their trees. Yet the roads as they existed were abysmal. Narrow, muddy, rutted, crooked, they wandered through hills and woods and over streams without plan or purpose. Only a handful of those streams were bridged. River fords were often guarded by men-at-arms who demanded coin or kind for the right to cross. Some of the lords whose lands the roads passed through maintained them after a fashion, but many more did not. A rainstorm would wash them out. Robber knights and broken men preyed upon the travellers who used them. Before Maegor, the poor fellows would provide a certain amount of protection to common folk upon the roads, when they were not robbing them themselves. After the destruction of the Starks, the realm's byways became more dangerous than ever. Even great lords travelled with an escort. To correct all these ills in a single reign would have been impossible, but Jaehaerys was determined to make a start. King's Landing, it must be remembered, was very young, as cities go. Before Aegon the Conqueror and his sisters had come ashore from Dragonstone, only a modest fishing village stood on the Three Hills where the Blackwater Rush flowed into Blackwater Bay. Not surprisingly, few roads of any note begin or end in modest fishing villages. The city had grown quickly in the 62 years since Aegon's conquest, and a few rude roads had sprung up with it, narrow dusty tracks that followed the shore up to Stokeworth, Rosby, and Duskendale, or cut through the hills to Maidenpool. Aside from that, there was nothing. No roads connected the king's seat with the great castles and cities of the land. King's Landing was a port, far more accessible by sea than land. That was where Jaehaerys would begin. The wood south of the river was old forest, dense and overgrown, fine for hunting, poor for travel. He commanded that a road be cut through it, to connect King's Landing with Storm's End. The same road should be continued north of the city, from the Rush to the Trident and beyond, straight along the Green Fork and through the Neck, then across the wild, trackless north to Winterfell and the Wall. The King's Road, the small folk named it. The longest and most costly of Jaehaerys's roads, the first begun, the first completed. Others followed. The Rose Road, the Ocean Road, the River Road, the Gold Road. Some had existed for centuries in ruder form, but Jaehaerys would remake them beyond all recognition, filling ruts, spreading gravel, bridging streams. Other roads his men created anew. The cost of all this was not inconsiderable, to be sure, but the realm was prosperous, and the king's new master of coin, Martin Tyrell, aided and abetted by his clever wife, the Apple Counter, proved almost as able as the Lord of Air had been. Mile by mile, league by league, the roads grew, for decades to come. He bound the land together and made of seven kingdoms one, read the words on the plinth of the old king's monument that stands at the citadel of Old Town. Mayhaps the seven smiled on his work as well, for they continue to bless Jaehaerys and Alysanne with children. In 63 A.C. the king and queen celebrated the birth of Vagon, their third son and seventh child. A year later came another daughter, Daella. 3 years hence, Princess Sarah came into the world, red-faced and squalling. Another princess arrived in 71 A.C., when the queen gave birth to her 10th child and 6th daughter, the beautiful Viserra. Though born within a decade of one another, it would be hard to conceive of 4 siblings so different from one another as these younger children of Jaehaerys and Alysanne. Prince Vagon was as unlike his elder brothers as night to day. Never robust, he was a quiet boy with wary eyes. Other children, and even some of the lords of the court, found him sour. Though no coward, he took no pleasure in the rough play of the squires and pages, or the heroics of his father's knights. He preferred the library to the yard, and could oft be found there reading. Princess Daella, the next oldest, was delicate and shy. Easily frightened and quick to cry, she did not speak her first word until she was almost 2, and even thereafter she was tongue-tied more oft than not. Her sister, Maegel, became her guiding star, and she worshipped her mother, the queen, but her sister, Lyssa, seemed to terrify her, and she blushed and hid her face in the presence of the older boys. Princess Sarah, 3 years younger, was a trial from the very start, tempestuous, demanding, disobedient. The first word she spoke was no, and she said it often and loudly. She refused to be weaned until past the age of 4. Even as she ran about the castle, talking more than her siblings Vagon and Daella combined, she wanted her mother's milk, and raged and screamed whenever the queen dismissed another wet nurse. 7 save us, Alysanne whispered to the king one night. When I look at her, I see Arya. Fierce and stubborn, Sarah Targaryen thrived upon attention, and sulked when she did not receive it. The youngest of the 4, Princess Viserra, had a will of her own as well, but she never screamed and certainly never cried. Sly was one word used to describe her. Vain was another. Viserra was beautiful, all men agreed, blessed with the deep purple eyes and silver-gold hair of a true Targaryen, with flawless white skin, fine features, and a grace that was somehow eerie and unsettling in one so young. When one stammering young squire told her she was a goddess, she agreed. We shall return to these 4 princelings, and the woes they visited upon their mother and their father, in due time. But for the nonce, let us take a step back, to 68 A.C., not long after the birth of Princess Sarah, when the king and queen announced the betrothal of their first-born son, Aemon, Prince of Dragonstone, to Jocelyn Baratheon of Storm's End. There had been some thought, after the tragic death of Princess Daenerys, that Aemon should wed Princess Alysa, the eldest of his remaining sisters, but Queen Alysanne firmly put the thought aside. "Alysa is for Baelon," she declared. "She has been following him around since she could walk. They are as close as you and I were at their age." 2 years later, in 70 A.C., Aemon and Jocelyn were joined in a ceremony that rivaled the golden wedding for its splendour. Lady Jocelyn, at 16 years old, was one of the great beauties of the realm, a long-legged, full-breasted maid with thick, straight hair that fell to her waist, black as a raven's wing. Prince Aemon was 1 year younger at 15, but all agreed that they made a handsome couple. An inch shy of 6 feet tall, Jocelyn would have towered over most of the lords of Westeros, but the Prince of Dragonstone had 3 inches on her. "There stands the future of the realm," Sir Giles Morrigan said when he beheld the 2 of them side by side, the dark lady and the pale prince. In 72 A.C., a tourney was held at Duskendale, in honour of young Lord Darklyn's wedding to a daughter of Theomore Manderly. Both of the young princes attended, together with their sister Alysa, and competed in the squire's melee. Prince Aemon emerged victorious, in part by dint of hammering his brother into submission. Later he distinguished himself in the lists as well, and was awarded his knight's spurs in recognition of his skills. He was 17 years of age. With knighthood now achieved, The prince wasted no time becoming a dragon rider as well, ascending into the sky for the first time not long after his return to King's Landing. His mount was blood-red Caraxes, fiercest of all the young dragons in the dragon pit. The dragon keepers, who knew the denizens of the pit better than anyone, called him the Bloodworm. Elsewhere in the realm, 72 AC also marked the end of an era in the north with the passing of Alaric Stark, Lord of Winterfell. Both of the strong sons he had once boasted of had died before him, so it fell to his grandson Edric to succeed him. Wherever Prince Aemon went, whatever Prince Aemon did, Prince Balon would not be far behind, as the wags at court oft observed. The truth of that was proved in 73 AC, when Balon the Brave followed his brother into knighthood. Aemon had won his spurs at 17, so Balon must needs do the same at 16, travelling across the reach to Old Oak, where Lord Oakheart was celebrating the birth of a son with 7 days of jousting. Arrayed as a mystery knight and calling himself the Silver Fool, the young prince overthrew Lord Rowan, Sir Alan Ashford, both Fosseway twins, and Lord Oakheart's own heir, Sir Dennis, before falling to Sir Rickard Redwine. After helping him to his feet, Sir Rickard unmasked him, bade him kneel, and knighted him on the spot. Prince Balon lingered only long enough to partake of the feast that evening, before galloping back to King's Landing to complete his quest and become a dragon rider. Never one to be overshadowed, he had long since chosen the dragon he wished to mount, and now he claimed her. Unridden since the death of the Dowager Queen Visenya 29 years before, the great she-dragon Vhagar spread her wings, roared, and launched herself once more into the skies, carrying the Spring Prince across Blackwater Bay to Dragonstone, to surprise his brother Aemon and Caraxes. "The Mother above has been so good to me, to bless me with so many babes, all bright and beautiful," Queen Alysanne declared in 73 AC, when it was announced that her daughter Maegel would be joining the faith as a novice. "It is only fitting that I give one back." Princess Maegel was 10 years of age and eager to take the vows. A quiet, studious girl, she was said to read from the seven-pointed star every night before sleep. Hardly had one child departed the Red Keep than another arrived, however, for it appeared that the Mother above was not yet done blessing Alysanne Targaryen. In 73 AC, she gave birth to her 11th child, a son named Gaemon, in honour of Gaemon the Glorious, the greatest of the Targaryen lords who had ruled on Dragonstone before the conquest. This time, however, the child came early, after a long and difficult labour that exhausted the queen and made her maesters fear for her life. Gaemon was a scrawny thing as well, barely half the size his brother Vhagar had been at birth 10 years earlier. The queen eventually recovered, though, sad to say, the child did not. Prince Gaemon died a few days into the new year, not quite 3 moons old. As ever, the queen took the loss of a child hard, questioning whether or not it had been through some fault of her own that Prince Gaemon had failed. Septa Lyra, her confidant since her days on Dragonstone, assured her that she was not to blame. "The little prince is with the Mother above now," Lyra told her, "and she will care for him better than we could ever hope to, here in this world of strife and pain." That was not the only sorrow House Targaryen was to suffer in 73 AC. It will be remembered that this was also the year that Queen Rhaena died at Harrenhal. Near year's end, a shameful revelation came to light that shocked both court and city. The amiable and well-loved Sir Lucamor Strong of the King's Guard, a favourite of the small folk, was found to have been secretly wed, despite the vows that he had sworn as a white sword. Worse, he had taken not one, but 3 wives, keeping each woman ignorant of the other 2, and fathering no fewer than 16 children on the 3 of them. In Flea Bottom and along the Street of Silk, where whores and panders plied their trade, men and women of low birth and lower morals took a wicked pleasure in the fall of an anointed knight and made bawdy japes about Sir Lucamor the Lusty. But no laughter was heard in the Red Keep. Jaehaerys and Alysanne had been especially fond of Lucamor Strong, and were mortified to learn that he had played them both for fools. His brothers of the King's Guard were even angrier. It was Sir Ryan Redwine who discovered Sir Lucamore's transgressions and brought them to the attention of the Lord Commander of the King's Guard, who in turn brought them to the King. Speaking for his sworn brothers, Sir Giles Morrigan declared that Strong had dishonoured all they stood for, and requested that he be put to death.